Bueno.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm good.
We got a. We have a.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have opened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for the Ides of March, March the 15th, 2017. We are gathered here today for the purpose of a public hearing, House Bill 5010, Housing and Community Services Department, Ms. Dyster.
It's actually 5012.
What did I say?
10.
You said 10.
Sorry. House Bill 5012.
Only the second mistake you ever made.
Right. Ms. Dyster.
Okay. Before you today, we have the Housing and Community Services Department. The current service level for this budget is about $1.1 billion. The majority of that has to do with non-limited funds associated with the agency's bond indentures, things like reserves, debt service, those kinds of things. But they do receive a fair amount of general fund as well. You'll see page 2 of the LFO overview will give you kind of a quick glance at what the 15-17 legislatively approved general fund amounts were in some of their programs as compared to the current service level and for 17-19. And what will be jumping out immediately is that it's lower, and that is because there were a number of one-time funds that were included in the legislatively approved budget amount that have since been backed out for the current service level. For 17-19. The co-chair's existing resources budget framework identifies reductions in the amount of 3.1% to the current service level for economic development program area agencies, of which this is one, for the general fund and lottery fund. Lottery funds in housing and community services, though, are completely dedicated to debt service on previous bonds that were issued. So really, those cannot be reduced because you have those debt service obligations that you must fund. Otherwise, the state defaults on its bonds, and that is not a good thing.
Those are ratings, right?
So, generally speaking, to meet that goal, you will be looking to the general fund types of the general fund programs to meet that reduction goal from current service level. And I think, as you will hear, none of those choices are likely to be very fun. Let's see. I think that pretty much other issues that you ought to be aware of. The agency did come before the February 2016 legislative session on a couple of points, one of which was a report about Oregon Volunteers. This is a commission within the agency's Central Services division that was moved into Housing and Community Services several biennia ago. It has been kind of an odd, you know, not really central to the mission of the agency. In the current biennium, they received a one-time operating subsidy of $250,000 associated with Oregon Volunteers. That is not included in 17-19, and that may require a decision with regard to what is to be done on a going forward basis to ensure that that commission is sustainable and continues to operate. The agency also in February came before the committee to propose, to give a preview of new performance measures that they might be proposing and get feedback from the agency. And you will see the feedback that was given to them back in February incorporated into their presentation today, and we'll have an opportunity to make decisions with regard to exactly what we want those to look like for 17-19. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Dyster? There being none, I will invite up Ms. Salazar, the director, and anybody else from Team Housing.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And with me today from my team are our Chief Financial Officer, Caleb Yant, and our Senior Research Analyst, Megan Bolton.
Thank you. And on behalf of the committee, welcome to Oregon. You haven't been on the job that long. You've taken on a formidable challenge, and we're glad you're here. Based on the conversation that we had in my office, the agency is very fortunate to have you. So welcome to our committee.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair. I appreciate that. I know we are scheduled to testify today as well as tomorrow. We have a range of information to present to you, so I'll go ahead and get started. What we wanted to do today was get started with presenting some background information for all of you on our vision and mission, a little bit about the recent history of the agency. There's been a number of changes that I'm sure many of you are aware of, and then talk a little bit about the environmental factors facing our agency, including talking specifically about what we mean when we talk about the housing crisis and what that looks like for Oregonians and how that impacts our programs. And then we'll switch gears and talk specifically about our budget landscape and budget drivers. So just as a reminder for folks about our agency and our work, our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and to live free from poverty. And our mission is to provide stable and affordable housing and to engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for Oregonians. So as you can see from the vision and mission statement of our agency, although we are absolutely a housing provider, our work is much broader than that, and we really look at the whole individual and the whole household and how we can provide opportunities. And there's a growing understanding amongst various industries and service providers that housing is really foundational and the way to tie together so many different social factors. So this is just a collection of quotes for you that really respond to that. And one of them that particularly speaks to me is from Children's Health Watch. It says, "Public investment in housing, including housing for homeless families and rental assistance for food insecure families, improves the health outcomes of vulnerable infants and young children and lowers healthcare spending." So there's a growing recognition, particularly from our colleagues in the healthcare sector, about the importance of providing safe and decent housing as a place to get started working with families to address so many other outcomes. We see housing as a platform for the families that we work with to address health, safety, education, and economic outcomes. And to accomplish this, we work across agencies for strategic alignment of our programs in the aim to achieve equity, fiscal sustainability, and the opportunity for prosperity. So now I wanted to give a little bit of historical perspective, at least recent history, of the agency. As many of you are aware, I came on board at OHCS as the new director in November of 2016, so I'm just a few short months in, and I still use the word new director. But the agency has been through considerable change in the last several years, and I'll walk through some of that. So in the 2011 to 2013 biennium, OHCS faced fiscal and programmatic uncertainty. A new director was brought on board in October of 2011 to address financial challenges at the agency. There was a lot of financial uncertainty. Some of that was caused by the foreclosure crisis and the impact on our loan programs, and to determine if the agency could go forward as is or if the agency should, in fact, be dismantled. As a result of that, the agency was restructured and reorganized. All new executive management was brought on board, and 12 positions, including 6 management positions, were eliminated. The agency went through a scenario build process to understand the existing threats facing the agency and to determine possible alternative delivery options for OHCS programs. At that time, the agency also eliminated its Portland office in a streamlining effort. Transition efforts began at that time with the goal to focus agency programs to be mission-oriented and financially sustainable. One of the things that was uncovered through this process was really a dialogue about the kinds of programs that were housed at OHCS. There were a number of programs that, while very worthy and valuable, did not align with the core mission of OHCS. So there was a lot of discussion around that. Same was true around staffing, as well as really trying to understand the true fiscal position of the agency.
Ms. Elazar, may I stop you there for just a moment? For the benefit of our new colleagues, new to the legislature or new to this committee, while you are going through a very compelling narrative, I want to just put a little bit of meat on the bones. This was a Herculean undertaking, and Margaret Van Vliet, who was Ms. Salazar's predecessor, undertook it with unusual, I think, compassion, given the amount of change that she was required to deliver, and professionalism. This was no small undertaking. This was an agency in crisis. And I just want to put some flavor about some of the work before the agency, in now that things are somewhat righted, the work that you still have, because the personnel there have been asked to go through a lot. And I just want to put a bit of an exclamation point so that the committee understands the difficulty that this agency went through.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair, for that context. It's much appreciated. So taking that framework, in the 2013 to 2015 biennium, OHCS went through this process and ended up recommending that the agency remain intact, but acknowledged that there were still lingering concerns about the fiscal sustainability of the program and program delivery. At that time, the OHCS budget had the second year of funding withheld, pending a report to the legislature on alternate service delivery models for 2015 and beyond. And that report focused on three core areas. One was how the agency could improve its service delivery. The second was effectiveness. And the third was fiscal sustainability. And in terms of improved service delivery, one of the key areas, just as an example that was identified, was in addition to a number of programs housed at the agency that didn't meet the core mission of OHCS, there was also an understanding that the agency had multiple advisory bodies and commissions overseeing various different programs that were pulling the agency in many different directions. So there was also a focus on the governance model and how the agency could move forward with a more cohesive and coherent application of an advisory body to oversee all of our efforts and really pull together all of those programs to be pulling in the same direction. With that report, the legislature did approve the report and ultimately did approve the second year of funding for OHCS. And in July of 2014, the agency published a new strategic framework focused on inward-facing strategic imperatives to really get the agency on more solid footing to address some of the challenges identified through this process and be able to really get us prepared to move into the next phase. And a few of the initiatives that have been the focus of the agency in the last couple of years include an effective and integrated policy and governance model. So, as I mentioned, pulling together all those various advisory committees into one cohesive Housing Stability Council, which is now in place, to deliver remarkable service and really focus on the customer service delivery aspect of the agency, to implement a financially sustainable business model. A lot of this was just getting our fiscal house in order and really having a better understanding of our fiscal position and the impact that different programs have on the agency's finances. Strengthening the agency's leadership skills at all levels and becoming a data and research-driven agency. And that's certainly a theme that you'll hear from our team over the course of our testimony, and you'll hear a little bit more about where our research work is headed in just a few moments. So then moving on to the 2015 to 2017 biennium, OHCS achieved a balanced budget through key activities. We reduced our staffing levels. We streamlined our operations and many of our programs. We transferred the food programs that had been housed at OHCS to other agencies that better aligned with their mission.
May I stop you and just ask a question? It came up in a conversation that I had this morning, particularly with respect to advocacy for the emergency housing assistance and some of the emergency food assistance. Were you absolved of any requirement to track how DHS was doing with the food programs, or am I asking the wrong person, or did you guys track that at all? Because there were some of us that were a little anxious about separating those.
Tracking that. Co-chair, I appreciate the question. I'll have to look into that with my team and get back to you on who's doing that tracking of the food
programs.
That'd
be great. Thank you.
The other key activity here, and this already came up certainly in the conversation from the LFO analyst, that general fund support was received during that time to offset the subsidy required to house the Oregon Volunteers Program. So that was in the 2015 to 2017 biennium. So as the agency worked on those strategic imperatives, there were a number of, I think, really terrific outcomes. The first I want to highlight is the improved governance and oversight of the agency. So the best example of this is that we now have a Housing Stability Council that is our advisory body that really has accomplished that work of pulling together all those different commissions and advisory bodies. There was a legislative change that was adopted that now provides clarity that Housing Stability Council has the policy-making and policy-driving role for the agency, and also confirms that that is in conjunction with the CAPO organization. So we now have more clarity. We still have work to do to really realize the vision of that body as being a policy-making body, but we now have the statutory framework to move forward in that direction. So that's just one great example. Through the terrific work of our CFO, who you'll hear from in a few moments, we have now aligned our revenues with our expenses, and we have a much better clarity of our fiscal position. We've implemented a risk rating system for our portfolio, and that really has to do with the affordable housing developments that are financed by OHCS that we oversee. We now have a system to be able to understand the risks facing those properties and where we need to focus our attention.
I might, Ms. Salazar, ask you when you come back in phase two, for the benefit of our new folks, some of your housing finance programs are some of the most complicated things I've ever seen. And particularly because we have a real estate professional on this panel who's new to the legislature, it might be and may know these programs like the back of his hand. I don't know. But it would be very helpful at a time when we're all talking about the housing crisis and what we can do to improve the amount of housing stock to have you give us a little tutorial on what might help would be very useful. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I appreciate that comment. One of the things that certainly is helping is some of the new programs that our agency received in the 2015 to 2017 biennium. The two really signature programs that we've been thrilled to stand up during this biennium are the LIFT program, which was a new $40 million program that provided 11Q bond authority for our agency to finance new affordable housing development. We'll be certainly discussing that in detail in our presentation. And then the mental health housing program, which was a $20 million program in lottery backed bond proceeds to develop new housing opportunities for persons with mental health needs, and we'll be talking in detail about that program as well. Launching those programs was a significant effort, but we're thrilled with where we are with those programs today. And then finally, of course, in the last biennium, we also participated in a Secretary of State performance audit. And I will now talk a little bit about that audit with you. So again, some context for you. The Secretary of State performance audit was a wide-reaching look at our agency's operations. I joke a little bit that on my very first day on the job, I received a draft of this audit in my inbox as a nice welcome present for me. But I actually do think the audit provides some extremely helpful constructive criticism and gives us a real roadmap of the things that we need to focus on to improve our operations. I think just building on the co-chair's comments around all the transition and change and turmoil at the agency over the last several years, I think the audit really showcases how much change we've gone through and then helps us understand where we need to move forward as an agency. So I wanted to highlight a few notes from the audit because I think they do help to understand where our budget is headed and where some of our programs are headed.
Ms. Salazar, I'll interrupt for just a moment. Ms. Dyster, if I'm not mistaken, the audit materials are posted to OLIS already?
Yes, they are in the supplemental material. They're labeled supplemental agency materials, and you can find the full copy of it as well as the agency response there that might help edify some of what you're about to hear. So,
thank you so much for sharing. The focus of the Secretary of State performance audit was on the issue of affordable housing preservation, and that's the work that needs to be done to understand the risks facing the existing affordable housing across the state of Oregon. A lot of this housing is in need of great repair. Just to let the committee know, this is an area that I focused on for the past decade and in my prior work. It's an area I'm very passionate about, so I was pleased to see that the audit took on this issue and really gave it focus. But as the agency started looking at affordable housing preservation, as the auditors looked at the issue of preservation, they also took a broader look at our agency, and they have a few key findings. So the first finding is that our agency efforts to preserve affordable housing are not sufficient. The auditors certainly recognize that OHCS, using some of the resources that we've been provided by the state and other resources, have preserved hundreds of units of affordable housing through our efforts. We lack a comprehensive strategy to identify and preserve affordable rental housing, and we need to do a better job of understanding which properties are at risk, getting ahead of that risk, and working with partners to develop a comprehensive strategy. I couldn't agree more, and this is something that we're going to be focusing on moving forward. The audit also found that strategic planning at the agency is not sufficient. One of the core findings of the audit is that our agency is compelled by statute to complete what's called a statewide housing plan. We're required to do a comprehensive look at affordable housing needs and inventory across the state, to understand housing markets across the state in different geographies and regions, facing different demographic groups, persons of different ethnicities, seniors, all sorts of different population types, to really understand the housing needs and the existing housing stock and where we need to make investments. We have not completed a statewide housing plan in quite some time. The good news is that even before the audit was released, our agency was hard at work on starting to develop a statewide housing plan. Some of the data work that we have done for the statewide housing plan, you'll see the benefit of in the presentation in a few moments. It really represents some of the data work that we've already done. The auditors found that in addition to a statewide housing plan, we lack a comprehensive strategic plan for our agency that really takes that information, digests it, analyzes it, and says, okay, now we know what the needs are and where the critical lack of housing is or where we need to make investments. Now, how is our agency going to take that information and use it to make strategic decisions about where we're going to focus our programs for the next 5 years? Again, we couldn't agree more. I think when we looked at the strategic imperatives work, that was really internal-facing work, really the goals to get our agency on solid footing, but those were not outward-facing goals. It really looked at how are we going to strategize and target our investments to make the greatest impact.
Chair?
Excuse me. Yes, Representative.
Sorry to interrupt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your work on this, are you working just internally with staff, or do you have outside partners? How are you working together to try to build as much, you know, good information available?
Thanks for the question. I'm co-chair and Representative Meek. So the statewide housing plan will be essentially a year-long effort. We've done some initial data work. We're wrapping up kind of the number-crunching phase, if you will, of the work. But we're going to be doing a robust platform of stakeholder engagement and regional engagement, and we are bringing on a consulting firm that will help us do this and has done some great strategic planning work with other agencies. So we hope that we'll get lots of different voices as part of the process.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You know, the other kind of key takeaways from the audit are better data management. So the auditors really highlighted the fact that as they started to look at the issue of affordable housing preservation, they were not able to get a clear report and inventory of our existing affordable housing. And when they started digging into that, they realized that our existing data systems are outdated and disjointed. We've had sort of system band-aids over the years, band-aids on top of band-aids, and we need to do a full-scale modernization of our data so that we can better understand our existing inventory of affordable housing. We can generate reports to understand the trends in housing, use that to inform decision-making, and also, incidentally, create a better user experience for our customers. So as Co-Chair Johnson mentioned, we have some complicated housing programs. They're further complicated by the fact that we don't have electronic application systems. We don't have an efficient way to intake information and produce those kinds of reports. So again, here, the good news is that we had already identified that data modernization was critical. Our work to address that issue was already underway, and we are in the process of procuring a new data system. We're looking to procure an off-the-shelf solution that is already being used by state housing agencies around the country so that we're not reinventing the wheel, we're not creating something from scratch, we're trying to come up with the most efficient process possible. And we're looking this year to not only bring on a new data system, but migrate our existing data from those disjointed systems all to the same platform, train up our staff and our customers so that we have a usable system by, hopefully, by this time next year. And then the final take-home point from the audit is something that I've taken very much to heart, which is the organizational challenges at the agency. I think, as we've already discussed here today, the agency has been through considerable change and turmoil in just a few short years. And, you know, certainly those of us in the management world understand that leading folks through change is hard, it's complicated, it takes time, and certainly the audit results reflect that we have a lot of work to do to engage our staff, make sure that they're involved in the decision-making process at the agency, that they can see themselves in the work, and that they have a voice in the agency's future. So we're hard at work making sure that they have new opportunities to engage, and that also includes really working with our Housing Stability Council to fully realize their new role as the policymaking and advisory body for our agency. So just a few minor projects that we're working on identified in the audit. I did want to let the committee members know that as we are working to address those big picture items in the audit and this big statewide housing plan, I also wanted to make sure that we didn't lose sight of the fact that we're in a housing crisis and we can't necessarily wait for a full-scale planning process to be completed before we clearly articulate for ourselves and for our stakeholders where we're focusing our attention and the activities that we're taking on this year. So I've engaged our leadership, and we've engaged staff at all levels of the agency to develop strategic goals just for the year of 2017. These are the high-level goals I'll talk through. Behind each of these goals are specific outcomes, specific metrics so we can measure our progress toward those outcomes, and specific activities so that we can hold ourselves accountable and also celebrate our success, learn from what's working, and understand what's not working that we need to retool. We'll be making all of this public after today in more detail so that our stakeholders are aware of what we're focusing on this year and they understand our progress. So the strategic goals that we've outlined for ourselves for this calendar year are, number one, to build a stronger OHCS that engages, supports, and challenges our employees. This includes not only efforts to engage our staff and our housing council, but also the efforts to identify new opportunities to generate revenue and program income so that we can expand our mission and expand our activities. The second goal is to build a stronger OHCS that engages and serves our communities. One of the things that's highlighted in the audit is a lot of our stakeholders, partners, and customers don't have great trust in our agency. We need to do a better job of communicating with our partners and rebuild that trust, and that's a big focus this next year. We are working to close the affordable rental housing gap for low-income households. We're working to prevent and reduce statewide poverty and homelessness. We're working to reduce home energy costs and to improve housing affordability through our energy services programs.
May I stop you right there? I'm going to grind on an old theme that I keep bringing up in this building, and that is you're struggling to find out how to help with these home energy cost reductions, and the Energy Trust of Oregon is awash in money. I know it was set up with certain purposes in mind, but it just hurts my heart that they're out hunting up activities to engage themselves in and that you've got a plan here. And maybe I'm asking a rhetorical question of my colleagues. Isn't it time to take a look at that place that just sloshes with money and others that are in that space struggle to come up with adequate funds to discharge a mission? I just think it's time we relooked at that whole operation. Hundreds of millions of dollars are sliding through that place with minimal, if any, real accountability. The mass is ended. You may go in peace.
Thank you, Co-Chair. We will definitely take that under advisement as we move forward.
Co-Chair Gumberg.
Well, if I could just make a comment from a different denomination, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to move back one notch, and we're talking about closing the rental housing gap. We're talking about closing the rental housing gap, which is absolutely enormous here in Oregon, and growing more enormous with the challenges that people have to get financing and the shortage of builders, and that that more Oregonians are coming into the state on a monthly basis than we are constructing housing for them to stay in as they arrive here. Give me just 30 seconds. 30 seconds. How do we close the gap when it's so enormous?
Co-Chair, I appreciate the question. I could talk for 30 hours on this topic. I'll give you 30 seconds. So we need to, first of all, set some targets and then try to meet them. And so one of the things I think we need to move toward as an agency is being able to really identify how many homes are we attempting to build this year, next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, so that we can track our success. One of the things I think we can focus on is, in addition to new construction, we can look at things like acquisition and really look at how we can help our partners to either acquire land or acquire existing motels, naturally occurring affordable housing that's not affordable, locked in with a rent restriction, but try to get some of that stock converted over to be affordable housing. That would be a pretty quick, relatively inexpensive way to get more affordable units in the mix. So those are a couple of ideas that we're looking at as we kind of explore options and alternatives in this next year that I'm going to be focusing on for sure. We also have a lot of rental assistance that is absolutely a lifeline for folks. We'll be talking through that. I think there might be ways to think about how to align our resources, whether it's energy resources or rental assistance resources, to figure out how we can use that to tie together to provide new juice to build affordable housing. So.
All right.
Those are some ideas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're all going to be talking a lot more about the housing gap as the session unfolds.
As that discussion occurs, I hope that we remember collectively that there are two sides of the ledger. There are renters and there are landlords. And if we set about to vilify one side of that equation, we maybe don't end up moving the ball down the court. The other thing is the relationship between our land use processes, which I think all of us as Oregonians value. But I would ask the question without an answer. Are those processes organized in such a way as to encourage appropriate development without the difficulties of working through that UGB expansion? I've just come off a 10-year process to expand a modest expansion of a UGB. We value good land use, but there's a point where it starts to strangle us.
Thank you.
Please
for your
continue.
Comments. Thank you. Switching gears, our goal six for this year really starts to focus in on home ownership. So as we, a lot of us focus a lot of our time on rental housing, but we know home ownership is a critical strategy as well, not only to get folks into stable housing environments, but also to help them to build wealth. And so we're working this year to expand access to home ownership, in particular to bridge the minority home ownership gap, which is a theme you'll hear us talk about throughout our testimony, because that is something that is of great importance to our agency. And then finally, to continue our work to avoid and resolve foreclosures, which are continuing to be an issue here in Oregon as well. So we wanted to switch gears. That's a background of our agency, the transition that we've gone through, some of the change of the agency, and our goals. Now we wanted to give you the budget landscape. And really the framework we wanted to talk about today is to give you some context for the housing work out there and the housing work that we're doing and some of the environmental factors facing our agency. So I'll start, and then I will ask our senior research analyst to give you some more detail. So some basic environmental factors for the state of Oregon. Our population continues to grow. We are now more than 4 million people. We were the 10th fastest growing state from 2014 to 2015. And I know at some point in the recent past, we were also the number one state for in-migration, meaning that more people were moving to Oregon than moving to any other state from within the United States. So we've become a very popular place for folks to move. Our population continues to age. 16% of our population is now over the age of 65, compared with 12.8% in 2000, and it's expected to continue to rise to more than 18% by 2020. You know, the implications for our agency as we go through our planning process is to really think about the aging population, the specific kinds of senior housing that might be required, related services, and other factors. The rate of growth among people of color was 63% from 2000 to 2014, compared to a growth rate of just 7% amongst the white population. You know, again, here, this demographic shift really has implications for our agency in terms of how we wrestle with equity issues, how we do appropriate outreach, how we work with culturally specific organizations to make sure that our programs are reaching all Oregonians effectively. There's been an uneven economic recovery across Oregon. I know that does not come to as news to those of you that work with rural communities. We have a very different landscape in the Portland metro area, for example, than we have in rural parts of the state.
May I comment on this, please?
Please. I'm sorry I didn't recognize you. Representative Rudin.
I didn't ask. So thank you, Chair. Every time I hear that statement, I feel like I just want to say something because economic development, or I'm sorry, the poverty that exists in my area in East Portland, East Multnomah County, I'm going to say it every opportunity I get, it's this huge pocket of poverty there. All of Portland Metro is not well and good. It's very, very poor out east of 82nd. So I just want to make a point that it's not just rural Oregon and suffering in pockets. So when we need to be thinking communities of concentrated poverty, not just rural versus urban, because that's not the issue. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. And then, as I mentioned at the top of my presentation, I think other public systems are increasingly really becoming aware of the housing crisis. It's impacting their ability to do their work, whether it's economic development, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education. We're increasingly seeing that strain impact other public systems as well. I wanted to take just a couple of moments to kind of break down what we talk about when we talk about affordable housing, because this underpins a lot of our programs and a lot of the information we'll be presenting to you today. So the kind of generally accepted term affordable housing is that a household is spending 30% or less of their income on housing costs. This is a kind of a national standard that came into play from HUD and from federal housing dialogues. It's been in place for several decades, so it's the kind of the national standard. In Oregon right now, and this is a tough kind of figure, but in Oregon right now, the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment is just over $1,000. Again, that's statewide. It's an average, so it doesn't represent different parts of the state, but it gives you just a benchmark to start with. When we start talking about housing programs, we can get into some deep jargon pretty quickly. As Co-Chair Johnson mentioned, we have some very complex programs, and so we wanted to unpack a little bit of this for you to help you understand who it is that we serve. When we talk about our programs, often they serve either 0 to 30% of area median income households, 30 to 60% of area median income, or 60 to 80% of area median income. So we wanted to give you a little bit of a picture of who those households actually are. So just as an example, for the 0 to 30% area median income household, which is considered extremely low income, in Oregon, that range is from 0 to 19,000 per year annual income. And you might think about this as a senior on a fixed income, Social Security, or a full-time minimum wage worker. That might be folks in that 0 to 30% extremely low income range. And at that income level, the affordable monthly housing cost is just $0 to $500. So that gives you a sense of what those folks might be able to afford. in the 30 to 60% range. This is what we consider very low income. Many of our programs are targeted to this income level. And in Oregon, the limit for very low income is up to $38,040 per year. So we might think about a very low income household as being a preschool teacher or two full-time minimum wage earners. And then finally, the low income level, which is up to 80% of median income, which is in Oregon capped at about $50,000 per year. The affordable monthly housing cost would be about $1,000 to $1,300 a month, so just barely able to afford that average two-bedroom apartment in Oregon. And it might include an auto mechanic or a carpenter, just as examples of folks that might earn that income level. So as we go through all the technical details of our programs, I know I like to keep in my mind these faces and these thoughts about who the folks are that we're actually serving at the end of the day through our housing programs. And now I'm going to ask our senior research analyst, Megan Bolton, to give you more detail on the housing crisis and environmental factors facing our agency. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg and committee members. For the record, my name is Megan Bolton, and I'm the senior research analyst at Oregon Housing and Community Services. So I just want to briefly discuss with you this afternoon some housing market trends that are affecting households all across the state. And the first slide that we're looking at here are homeownership rates. And this shows that these rates across the, really homeownership rates across the country have been on the decline since the foreclosure crisis began, and Oregon's no exception to that. As shown in this slide, Oregon's homeownership rate has typically been below the national average. The U.S. homeownership rate really has been steadily declining since 2005. Oregon's steepest decline has been since 2012 and reached a low of 61.1% in 2015. And as of 2015, Oregon had the eighth lowest homeownership rate in the U.S. This decline in homeownership, combined with the significant population increases that Director Salazar just mentioned, has really led to this increase in the number of renters throughout Oregon, adding pressure to an already tight rental markets.
May I interrupt you, please? Absolutely. Senator Hansel.
On the decline of ownership, I'm just curious, do we have the same number of owners, but we have more people, therefore the percentage is lower?
It's a great question. Thank you, Senator Hansel, Co-Chair Johnson. Actually, no. It's both a lower rate and lower numbers of homeowners over the years, which is surprising considering the population increase. I can double check and send the numbers as well, but that's what we've seen.
Any questions that you're responding to, if you would get it to the professional staff and then they can distribute it to the committee, would be appreciated.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Making matters worse is the fact that the total number of new residential housing permits plummeted from a high of more than 31,000 in 2005 to a low of around 6,900 in 2010. This has slowly been increasing since 2010 and reached about 17,500 in 2015, but construction has not kept up with demand, which has led to record low rental vacancy rates. So this next slide shows those vacancy rates, both homeownership and rental, for Oregon and the U.S. So this slide shows that homeownership and rental vacancy rates homeownership vacancy rates in Oregon have really trended pretty closely with the national rates. But the statewide rental vacancy here in Oregon has historically been one of the lowest in the country. In 2011 and 2013, it was the lowest in the U.S. at 4% and 3.9% respectively. And in 2014, it was the second lowest rate in the country. And it's really remained below 5% even through 2016, and that's often considered the standard for a balanced housing market. And we know that actually in some parts of the state, the rental vacancy rate is much lower than this. In some surveys done in Central Oregon, they show that the rental vacancy rates there are hovering around 1% or even below in Bend. In tight rental markets, we know that rents can rise dramatically because of the increased demand and competitiveness among renters. Along with leading to higher rents, a low supply of vacant units decreases mobility among households. And with fewer units available, people have a more difficult time moving to be closer to a job or needed services. The next slide, this is showing HUD's fair market rents for various regions of the state from 2007 to 2016. All rents here are adjusted for inflation to 2016 dollars. HUD's fair market rents are really used to set payment standards for some of HUD's programs, and they're intended to represent the rent someone looking for housing would find on the market for a modest two-bedroom apartment. It's sort of the best national data set on rents that's available, but it does have its flaws. Some and many recognize that these are often a little behind the times. But in fact, the spike that's shown on this slide for Portland, the orange line there, is really due to the fact that the metro area housing authorities came together to contest the fair market rent and kind of do an independent rent survey. But they are showing that rents are going up, and I will note that what we do know is that from 2008 to 2015, family median incomes decreased 1.8%, while median gross rents increased by 9.8%. So that's the trend we've really been seeing. Incomes were either stagnant or decreasing across the state, while rents were increasing. And furthermore, there are other data sources such as Zillow indicate that places like Bend and Prineville are actually the top two cities in the country with the greatest change in rents from 2011 to 2016, with increases of 54% and 46% respectively. And we know that these kinds of dramatic rent increases are happening across the state.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe.
And you know, because I happen to be in this business, I know that within the Portland metro area, there are dramatic differences in rent increases. Again, inside of the Beltway, which we say 82nd, where my brother happens to own a number of rental units, rents have been skyrocketing, whereas farther east in the poverty area that Representative Reardon talked about and the David Douglas and Reynolds community, rents have gone up, but much slower, and they're at a much lower, more modest rate than just a mile farther to the west.
Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A procedural question, if I may. Most of the slides that you've been showing us terminated with the year 2015. This slide terminates with the year 2016, which has some actually dramatic consequences. What's going on?
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, and thank you, Senator Monroe.
Let me clarify. I'm not asking what's going on with fair market rents. I'm asking
some slides
have a different termination date than others.
Understood. It's just the data sources I'm pulling them from. So HUD does fair market rents. They kind of project forward to current years, whereas most of the other data comes from American Community Survey data from the census, which tends to have a lag.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If we took out 2016, the slide would tell a much different story.
Yep.
Indeed it would.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm a little confused. I'm not sure I'm interpreting this correctly, and I want to make sure that I am. So if I look at this, it would look like the market rents have been across the state relatively stable, I mean, some growth. And there's only a Portland metro area, but that doesn't fit with my bias or what I believe to be true. So could you clarify that for me or just tell me I'm right or what's going on?
Yes, thank you, Representative Reardon and Co-Chair. I would love to. Fair market rents are a little tricky, and it's unfortunate for all of us that this is sort of the best rent data that we have. The methodology is sort of using old 5-year American Community Survey data from the census and projecting it forward. And it's simply that there's often a very big lag, and this just simply isn't capturing actual rent increases across the nation, really. And one of the issues in particular is American Community Survey data uses median gross rents, which includes all rents being rented by households, whereas you'd really prefer to look at what's kind of asking rents on the market right now. They sort of try to get to that, but they don't do a great job. So it's a flaw in the data we have. We are in our state planning process. We are really working to kind of find local rent surveys and understand what's a little bit better, what's kind of happening happening in reality. But this is sort of the best kind of national data set that we can use across counties and metro areas. And I think, you know, there what you're hearing, I think we all know, you know, we hear that rents are increasing quite dramatically, and we're going to try to get to that in other ways. I don't know. I hope that it's not a great answer. I wish I had better rent data.
we're going to be asked to make policy here shortly and actually push the magic button on that will have to do possibly with, you know, preempting, allowing individual cities to make their housing decisions or not. And this sort of data might affect my thinking on that. And so I wonder, is there a later slide coming up that has something that's more helpful? This just raises uncertainty.
Certainly, Representative and Co-Chair. I think one of the things that we could do is look at some of our more detailed information. These are really high-level slides for this presentation, but we could certainly look back and see what other research we have. I think what's hard about this particular slide is the spike in Portland kind of skews everything else in terms of the scale. So, you know, some of the other parts of the state, you know, $100 or $200 a month rent increase is still very significant for those communities. It's just that the scale gets a little skewed. But we can take a look and see what other additional information we can provide that would be helpful.
Anything you can do would be really helpful.
Absolutely. And I'll add that there are a lot of just kind of data that you can purchase, but even that is often really only available in metro areas, so it can be especially tricky to get to what's really happening in a lot of rural areas.
One last comment.
Please.
Thank you. And so something also showing percentage of change in an area might be helpful as well.
Sure.
So, because I recognize if you change it from $700 to $900,
right,
that's a big change.
Right. Yeah. Certainly.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the comments.
Thank you. We will provide some more detail on that.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So what a lot of this means is that households are paying much more of their income on housing costs across the state. This increased competition for scarce rental housing has led to increases in the percentage of households with severe rent burden, which means that households are paying more than half of their income on housing costs. And as you can see here, this sort of breaks it out by those income levels that Margaret was mentioning earlier, and shows that really it's the lowest income households who are struggling most, with the percentage of extremely low income households with severe burden ranging from 62% in Eastern Oregon to 81% in Central Oregon. And while it's especially, you know, you can see that it's especially difficult for the lowest income renters, this is true across the board, that the kind of number and percent of folks facing the severe housing burden has increased across the board. It increased from 19% in 2000 up to 27% in 2014. And on the next map, you can see kind of the severe housing cost burden by county. The dark red counties are where the highest proportions of severely rent-burdened renters live. And again, that's the statewide percentage is at 27%. And that dark red, the range there is about 31% to 38%. So low-income households that spend more than half their income on housing costs have very little money left over each month for basic necessities such as childcare, health care, transportation, or any savings, and are therefore really at an increased risk of homelessness. This next slide talks a little bit more about homelessness. So these are statewide figures from the 2015 point in time count that indicate that there were 13,176 people experiencing homelessness in Oregon on a particular night in January when the count was done. 44% were sheltered and 56% were unsheltered. Oregon has one of the top five highest percentages of unsheltered homeless people in the country. And I did not include 2016 numbers because not every continuum of care is required to do an unsheltered count in 2016, so the unsheltered numbers aren't completely comprehensive. We will be getting 2017 numbers by this summer.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, those in tents don't count as sheltered, right?
They count as unsheltered.
We get a lot of those
Correct.
In Portland.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Monroe, and co-chair.
And do we know what time of year this particular data was collected?
It's Co-chair, the point in time is always done in January.
I'm sorry, Representative Noble, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair. Just a question with your data and statistics in general and your sources. You had mentioned a couple slides ago that you had less confidence, if I understood you correctly, in the accuracy of what fair market value was. And just my concern, and I may be totally off, that's why I'm asking, is we're building a foundation and a stronger foundation on what I understand to be somewhat shaky data. Anecdotally, I have no problem with rents are going up and we have a problem and a gap. Mm-hmm. But I'm just concerned about making stronger statements based on data and maybe has a foundation that is less shaky. How do you compare the U.S. Census data with HUD and versus this data here, just for my own confidence in what sure. we're seeing?
So thank you, Representative Noble and Co-Chair. The American Community Survey data is very reliable. It can be reliable down to the census tract level. One of the only kind of issues with it is that there's a lag in the timing. So right now the most recent data is from 2015. And if you do want to look at county level data or further lower geographies, you have to use 5 years of data together to really have that be statistically reliable. And that right now, the most recent is 2011 to 2015. So it's very good data. It's collected every year. It's an incredibly well executed survey. But there's this lag. So that's what HUD uses to then project the fair market rents. And they just use some basic projections forward. And I think often those projections forward don't take into account the kinds of housing market trends that are happening in Oregon you can't always take into account in that way. The point in time count, there are often some concerns that it perhaps undercounts the unsheltered population, certain communities, certainly. But these are, I think what's great about a lot of this data is it's benchmarks. And I think it does help you, no matter what, it helps you understand the changes over time and the trends. And it's kind of what we can use to understand what's happening and where, what's improving, what's getting worse, and where kind of we need to insert ourselves.
Senator Hansel.
Maybe I missed on a slide before, but what is the percentage in Oregon of homeless, of a total population? Because I'm assuming that these are percentages not of the total population, but the percentage of homeless
of the
population.
Correct. It's a very small percentage, and I don't know it off the top of my head, but I can find that and get that to you.
And I guess, I don't question, but we've got a big state, and at a point in time, how do you know how many are homeless in Wallowa County? I mean, you can't, I don't know. One hand question the figures, but on the other hand, I wonder, well, how accurate are they? I mean, how do you know?
Senator and co-chair, we really appreciate the question. We've wrestled with this ourselves, and it's a very important question. The point in time count is done in counties all across the state, so every county participates. Every continuum of care is the term of art that HUD uses for the homeless funding programs participates. So there is representation. There are a lot of critiques about the methodology for the point in time count, and when I first saw the 13,000 figure, I kind of did a common sense check on myself and said that seems extremely low to me, just from a common sense gut check as we, experience homelessness in our communities. This is the best information that we have, and it's done nationally the same, week every year to try to get a national perspective. There's a lot of critiques about why in the world is it done in January. I think in a lot of larger urban centers where there are a lot of shelters, it's a good way to kind of bring people into shelters and do that count because they're less likely to be in unsheltered environments. But that looks a little different in states like Oregon where you do have folks more spread out and you have less of a shelter infrastructure. So there's more of a risk of undercounting. But I think to Megan's point, we don't have utmost confidence that this is absolutely the most accurate figure, but it is a benchmark that we can look at over time or comparing communities to communities throughout the state to understand the trends that we're looking at.
Quick follow-up. So
please.
When you said 13,000, is that what that in?
Yes.
So the sample base or the total was 13,000 for the, okay.
Let's continue then.
Okay, thank you for the questions. This is my last slide. So this last slide of mine shows that rental housing gap, specifically for extremely low-income households. So we know that there are around 143,000 renter households in Oregon at that 0 to 19,000 income level, and just about 38,000 rental units that are both affordable and available to those households, meaning they're affordable at those rent levels that Margaret mentioned, and that they are not being occupied by a higher income household. So that's a shortage of about 105,000 units. One in four renters in Oregon is actually considered extremely low income, but for every 100 extremely low income renters, there are just 26 units affordable and available to them. And according to a recent report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, this is the third lowest number in the country, just behind Nevada and California and tied with Arizona. Nationally, that number is about 35 units. And we know that this affordable housing shortage in Oregon affects households in all parts of the state. And I think that's my last slide, so thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Megan. Thank you. And I wanted to ask our CFO, Caleb Yant, to begin the presentation on the budget summary. So I'll turn things over to Mr. Yant.
Yeah, thank you, Director Salazar, Representative Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Caleb Yant. I am the Chief Financial Officer for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And it's my honor to be able to spend the next few minutes going over some of the high-level information in our budget. And so I'll be looking at our budget by fund type and then kind of break down by how the money is used and the different program areas we use it for. Then we'll be looking at our organizational structure and finish with some of the key budget drivers and risks for our funding and then some of the highlights of what is in the governor's budget for 2017-19. So jumping right in as far as our budget summary by fund type. So at the highest level, you can see that the 2017-19 budget is a $1.18 billion budget. That's down about $100 million from what we saw in the 15-17 legislatively approved budget. And then if we look at it by fund types, the federal funds, we don't have the percentages on there, but it's about 21% of our budget is from federal funds. About 76% of our budget is other funds, and I'll go into a minute why we have that broken out. About 2% of our budget does come from general fund, which includes the debt service. And then about 1% is the other funds that Ms. Neister had talked about in her presentation. So I want to highlight a couple of the reasons that we broke the general fund out and the other fund out. So Margaret alluded earlier to the Article 11 Q bonds that we received to implement the LIFT program in the 15-17 biennium. That was $40 million, and we'll talk about the outcomes of that program later in the presentation. But in 17-19, we, for the first time, have debt service that is paid for by the general fund, and it seemed important to break that out when we're comparing 15-17 to 17-19, so you can see the impact of the general fund that goes specifically to the programs that we deliver that are supported by the general fund. We did the same breakout between the other funds, the limited and the non-limited, much for the same reason. So the limited portion of our other funds did go up from 15-17 to what is in 17-19. And that really is associated with the programs that we deliver that rely on other fund revenue sources. And again, we'll be getting into those in a little bit. But it seemed like it was important to show the breakout because while that went up, the non-limited portion, which is really related to the loans that we purchase through our bond program and the debt service that we pay on our bonds, that went down drastically more than the amount that the limited portion went up. And when we get to the budget drivers in a couple slides, I'm going to kind of elaborate on the reasons for that. The next slide here, again, it shows 15-17 compared to 17-19, but it takes a slightly different angle, and it's looking by the usage. So it compares operating costs to the dollars that go out to program payments and the money that is related to our debt service and our bond costs. So there's a couple of things that I want to highlight for you here. Specifically, when I was looking at this, the thing that jumps out to me is the fact that our operating cost went up at the same time that our program payments went down. And so I want to explain the reason behind that. As far as the operating cost went up, you see it went up by about $3.4 million from biennium to biennium. And that is very much related to the fact that in 2017-19, we have 10 additional positions in our budget. So the vast majority of that increase is from that, from those positions. And we'll be talking about that a little bit later, but from the highest level, four of those are for new or changed programs, and six of those are to address some of the key capacity concerns that were discussed as part of the audit and that we've recognized as a need to address as an agency. So the majority of that increase is related to those additional positions. The rest of it is the standard inflation factors for cost of living adjustments and that sort of thing. The program payments going down by about $32 million from 15-17 to 17-19 really speak to those one-time funding elements that Ms. Dicer had mentioned earlier. So specifically, there was $10 million in the EHA, or Emergency Housing Assistance, and SHAP, State Homeless Assistance Program, that we received in the 2016 legislative session. That was one-time funding, and a little bit more detail on that. The EHA portion of that, which is $8 million, we are allowed to transfer that from the general fund to the other funds and spend it out of the other funds. So from a budget perspective, that's counted twice. And so really, you know, that just that one portion of the temporary funding go away is $18 million. We also had one-time funding for the Oregon Energy Assistance Program that does low-income bill pay assistance, which is expiring in 2018. And so that's a reduction of $5 million. And there was $4.2 million for Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program, which is foreclosure mediation counseling. So those were money, one-time money that was in 15-17, not in 17-19, and that accounts for about 27 of that $32 million decrease. So the next two slides here take a slightly different approach to the same thing. They both exclude the debt service and bond costs. It's not that those aren't critical, but as we look at what portions of our agency do we have programmatic oversight, decision-making, and administration of, it really is this portion of our budget. The debt service, those bond-related activities, we're going to pay our debt service. One of the key drivers is to make sure we maintain our bond ratings. And so even though that's critical activity, we don't have a lot of decision-making around it. So it seemed important to highlight of the part that we do, what is that comprised of? And so you can see at a very high level, the $672 million that goes to those activities, how it's broken down. So 94% of that goes to program payments, and the other 6% goes to the administration of those programs. And then the next slide further drills into that, and it gives you kind of a comparison of what was in 15-17 to 17-19 through the different program areas. And so you can see here that from that $672 million, about 26% of that goes to our single family and home ownership programs, which includes the Oregon Bond Program, which we'll get into later. About 24% of it goes to our multifamily housing development type of programs. And one note on the multifamily, a significant tool that we have, which speaks to Co-Chair Johnson's complexity of some of our housing development programs, is the low-income housing tax credit program. That is equity that comes into these projects to develop this low-income housing. That is money that never flows through our budget. And so we administer that, but that is not included in the dollars that you see here. So that's the multifamily. There's the HUD project-based contract administration. That's Section 8 project-based vouchers that we administer a contract for HUD. About 20% of our budget is energy services and weatherization services for low-income Oregonians. 6.4 is homeless services and anti-poverty type of programs related to that, and then a variety of the other functions within our budget. So this next slide just really gives you a kind of a high level idea of how our organization is structured. So you can see that we have 159 positions in the 17-19 budget. It has a breakout of 27 of those are limited duration positions, and 132 are permanent positions. And Marg is going to speak to this in a few minutes when I hand it back to her to start to dive into our programs. But from a program delivery perspective, we really kind of have two sides of the house. We have our housing stabilization division, which really does a lot of the anti-poverty program type of work. And then we have our housing finance division, which does a lot of the affordable housing development work. And so from a program delivery perspective, those are kind of the two main divisions. And then we have our central services division, which does budget, finance, information security, public affairs director's office, HR, those type of activities. So the next two slides, there's the budget drivers and really risks to our funding, and then it's the overview and some of the highlights of what is in the governor's budget. This slide has 5 points, and I'm really going to kind of take these one by one and dive into these at a little deeper level. So the first bullet point on here speaks to shrinking balance sheet and limited profits from our bond indentures. Excuse me. So historically, OHCS has issued tax-exempt mortgage revenue bonds. And so the tax-exempt nature of these bonds allow us to get a really low interest rate, and we turn around and we lend the proceeds of those bonds out to low and moderate income borrowers at a rate that is better than what the market can offer, but still higher than what we pay on the debt service on those bonds. And so the difference between the bond yield and the mortgage yield is considered called the yield spread, and that historically has been a source of operating income for OHCS. That amount is limited by the IRS, but that has been a significant source of operating income since really the inception of OHCS.
What's that equate to? Do we have the figures of how much income that is for the department?
How much? Well, there's limits. So, yeah, Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, there's limits to, the IRS puts limits on it. So it's 1 1/8 if it's for the single family program, and 1.5 if it's for the multi-family program, the difference between the bond yield and the mortgage yield.
Okay, but what's the how many
the amount of dollars? The bottom line is we can pull $6.1 million a year out of our bond indentures. So, and I might as well say now, there's a lot that goes into this. And one of the attachments in OLIS is a pretty detailed analysis and some of the drivers behind that. We contract out with an independent financial advisor, and they really take our audited financial statements every year and do a lot of the quantitative work to say, okay, based off of the reserve requirements that you need to maintain your bond rating and look at a lot of the different factors that go into that, how much can we take out each year to help cover program costs and agency operations? And so there's about a 10-page document that is as short as I could get it to, and it's in OLIS that is talking about that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I probably won't read the document, but I appreciate it, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know, and where I was going with that is that this model has historically worked really well for us, and that works well when interest rates are high, and we have a competitive advantage because these are very market-driven products. As we all know, since 2008, interest rates have been at historically low levels, which means that our products are not viable or are very limited in their viability. So at the same time where we've had a hard time being, you know, having a market-driven product, the interest rates have been low. So the loans that are existing on our balance sheet, have the homeowners have been able to take advantage of low interest rates and have refinanced or have just sold their home and paid off their mortgages. So when I talk about shrinking balance sheet, that's what I'm talking about is over, you know, since really 2008, we're getting a lot more payoffs than we're able to originate new loans. And just by a degree of magnitude, we have our audited financial statements on our website, and over the last 2 years, from 2014 to 2016, that amount has dropped by $208 million in liabilities, or 21% of the liabilities on our balance sheet. And I kind of already spoke to the limited profitability and based off that analysis. So that's the first part that that first bullet point. The second bullet point there is really speaking to the federal tax credit market and causing gaps in the pipeline projects. And so Margaret will get into this in a lot more detail in a few minutes as we're talking about the low-income housing tax credit. But as you all know, there's a lot of discussion about the possibility of corporate tax reform. And even though there's a lot of unknowns, this has impacted the pricing that we're getting on the tax credits that are in some of the projects that are in their pipeline. So to elaborate on that a little bit more, there's 33 projects in our pipeline. 11 of those projects came in through a competitive process to get tax credit. So 22 came through the non-competitive side, and we'll get into a little more detail there. But suffice to say, there's 33 projects in our pipeline that had funding. They're at some point of development, they had funding, and now they didn't have firm commitments on that tax credit pricing, and so they're seeing funding gaps. And so we've been working with our Housing Stability Council and our stakeholders to figure out how to address this, and we're very committed to making sure projects that are in our pipeline are able to proceed. But that certainly is a risk and something that we're keeping a close eye on. Another portion is the uncertainty regarding federal funding. So as I stated earlier, 21% of our budget is from federal funds, and you probably heard from other agencies that have federal funding as a significant portion of their budget. There's a lot of uncertainty and unknown, and we're watching that closely. I think one key area that I'll highlight here, actually a couple. So our two main federal funders are HUD and Department of Health and Human Services. And specific to HUD, we have that Section 8 performance-based contract. That's $121 million of our budget in and of itself. And we pay, pay those rents for those clients. That's 11 full-time employees in our agency, and the revenues that we get from that contract are in excess of the cost of delivering that contract, and so we get about $1.3 million in operating subsidy from that contract. HUD is currently talking about the possibility of removing that from a state level and moving that to more of a regional or a national level, and so we're very active and watching that and engaged in that conversation, but that is a very real funding risk, and one example of things that we're watching from the federal funding level. Uncertainty regarding Oregon Volunteers and the court-appointed special advocates. So Ms. Dicer pointed out that there was a report to this committee in the 2016 session as far as the future home and financial sustainability of Oregon Volunteers. Oregon Volunteers is an organization that is very mission-oriented, but is not in alignment with the mission of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We have been kind of a default home for them for a while, and it was always meant to be a temporary home, and they're actively working on finding their permanent home, and we're very much supporting them to move to their permanent location that really aligns with their mission.
Senator.
But doesn't Casa in Spanish mean home?
Indeed it does, Senator Hansel, Co-Chair.
That's why they got in the first place.
Probably the only connection it would have with your department.
And the final point on that slide is the new legislation and programs that could stretch the capacity of OHCS staff. So as you're aware, and you know, we're excited at the attention on housing. It's a critical need. But just by accounts last week, there was 12 task forces or studies that OHCS was either participating or helping to administer. There's a possibility of 14 new programs. There's additional fundings for programs in 8 bills, and there were 12 bills that either added elements to our programs or changed elements of our programs. So as we're talking about budget drivers, there's a lot of active conversations now, and that's something that could impact our budget.
That to me, Mr. Chairman, it's more of a statement than a question. I mean, we're trying to keep this great department functioning and moving, and yet we just keep adding more and more. You know, like we added CASA, for Pete's sakes. I mean, there isn't much of a fit there, but, you know, I think as legislators, we need to take a better look at that.
Thank you for that feedback, Senator. All right. Where are we at now?
Thank you, Co-Chair. And so the last slide that I'm going to go over before handing it back to Director Salazar is just to highlight some of the information that is in the governor's budget. And so just you know, three kind of main bullet points I want to highlight is one-time funding that is included in the governor's budget. So there's $60 million for the Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program, the LIFT program that we talked about earlier, and we'll talk about a lot more here in a little bit. We had $40 million in 15-17, and this budget proposes an additional $60 million for that program. There's $10 million proposed for lottery bonds with flexibility in use. Traditionally, that has been used for preservation of housing with expiring federal rent subsidies, and this certainly can be used for that, but what is in the governor's budget also has a flexibility to be used for manufactured park preservation, as well as to be used as gap financing to leverage this 4% low-income housing tax credit, which is a resource that could be utilized.
Excuse me, Caleb, but I thought I heard you say the $60 million, is it, that's an additional $60 million over the 40, so it's 100?
Senator Hansel, Co-Chair, yes, that is correct. There was 40 in 15-17, and this proposes a 60 in 17-19, totaling 100 between the two biennia. The second point there is critical general fund programs at current service level. So this budget does not propose a cut from current service level for some of these key general fund programs for our agency. So emergency housing assistance, the state homeless assistance program, low-income rental housing fund, and that elderly rental assistance, which is a new program coming over to us from the Department of Revenue. And we'll be talking about these all in more detail here shortly. And then the final element here is funding to increase staff capacity in some key areas. So LIFT was a very new program for us. This is the first time we've done this, and we'll be talking about that in a little bit. But there's three positions in the governor's budget to administer those. Two of them are full-time. And then there's also positions for data and research, multifamily, and single-family, really to augment and expand our capacity in those areas. A total of 6 between the three of which are general fund funded, 3 of which are funded by other funds.
Question again, please.
Yeah, what matching funds would we, what additional matching funds would we get with the additional $60 million state funds? Are you going to cover that later on? Or?
Senator and Co-Chair, I believe what you're asking is, so if we have a $60 million additional funds for the LIFT program, what other funds would come into that?
Yeah, the heading says leverage private equity and federal funds. So
certainly.
What do we pick up additionally?
Certainly. And as we get into more detail about the accomplishments of the LIFT program to date and the initial $40 million, we can talk through this in more detail. But there's a program called the 4% Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which is a federal program. It's a non-competitive resource. We're limited only by the private activity bond volume cap for the state of Oregon. It's been historically underutilized, not just in Oregon, but nationally. It's a great program, but it doesn't provide usually enough juice to really get into a development and fully fund it. So what we found in the initial round of LIFT is that 9 of the 12 awardees were proposing to use LIFT together with that 4% federal tax credit. And when we are able to allocate that 4% tax credit, then those project sponsors are able to syndicate or sell those credits to private investors who then infuse the project with private equity. And so these are private equity investors that would not be investing in affordable housing were it not for that 4% tax credit. So we think that LIFT and 4% together is a really great match, and we're seeing that play out with the initial round of LIFT projects that have been funded to date.
Please.
Okay. And at this point, I will hand it back to Director Salazar to go into more detail on our programs.
Certainly. Well, Director Salazar, I've heard Mr. Yant say on a number of occasions that you're going to give us more detail in a couple of minutes, but I sense we only have a couple of minutes left.
That's right.
And I'm wondering if we should hold over for the begin the program summary when we reconvene tomorrow.
Yes, I think that would be it's a great breaking point for us to pick up on the presentation tomorrow.
All right. Any questions for this panel before we break today, colleagues?
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Deister, do you have anything?
I'm here all week.
All right. Well, then we will be back here again tomorrow afternoon to continue to talk about housing. And I will close the public hearing, and I will adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.